Welcome to a new season of Over Underrated with Fran and Babs. I am Babs and I'm happy to welcome you to season 7 and a special episode. So if you're a regular listener, you know how this normally works. Me and Fran, sometimes a special guest or two, pick a theme and then pick a musical act that might be considered overrated in that theme and underrated within that theme, making the case through 5 or 10 track playlists. But this is a special episode, as I mentioned, because we are welcoming the writer, musician, DJ and film producer Bob Stanley today. So Bob Stanley is one of the founders of Saint-Étienne, and he's enjoyed a parallel career as a music journalist, and he's contributed to a lot of publications such as The Times, Smash Hits, Enemy, The Guardian and The Face. So the reason that Bob's come on our podcast is to talk about two of his books that cover a lot of pop history. We'll be talking about Yeah Yeah Yeah, The Story of Modern Pop, which has just been re-released 10 years after with a new chapter. And we'll be talking about Let's Do It, The Birth of Pop, which won the Penderyn Music Book Prize in 2023. So in brief, Yeah Yeah Yeah, The Story of Modern Pop is a pop history from the 1950s till the present day, with quite a bit of focus on the UK and the US. And Let's Do It is a fascinating early 20th century music history, which has been defined as the first such history bringing together all musical genres to tell the definitive narrative of the birth of pop from 1900 to the mid-1950s. So we were very lucky to get copies of those books and ask Bob questions about them. But this is still Over Underrated, so we asked Bob to pick 5 underrated acts that he talks about in his books that he thinks might be interesting to our listeners. So we have some fascinating discussions coming up of some kind of hidden gems from especially the 1950s and 60s for you to get involved in, and one from the 90s too, we can say that. So we hope you enjoy this special episode and see you on the other side.
Welcome to the Over Underrated podcast with Fran and Babs.
Welcome to another episode of Over Underrated with Fran and Babs, a special episode today. How are you, Fran?
I am back in England and I've been trying to get back into the workflow. And obviously I've been listening to far too many podcasts and far too many playlists. And I'm drowning. I'm trying to catch up on all of the music I haven't heard in the 90s. And that might take me some time, to be fair.
No mean feat.
How about yourself?
I have been a bit more laser focused. I have been listening to a German band called Die Nerven, who I saw in Antwerp a few weeks ago. They were fantastic. Totally apathetic audience, as can be the case here in Belgium, but they were really, really funny and one of those, you know, three pieces that absolutely fill the room. And I was reminded that their song Europa I almost picked for our Best of 2022 episode, mm-hmm. but it didn't quite make it. So I've been listening to a lot more of their back catalogue and would really recommend some good German noise rock, post-punk, bit of everything.
Well, they don't get a lot of airplay on our podcast, the noise rock, so maybe it will be a future episode.
I would love that. I think we're here to talk about much more than noise rock today. We are not alone. We are joined by a special guest, writer, musician, DJ and film producer, Bob Stanley. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm all right. How are you?
Good, good. What have you been listening to, Bob, recently that you'd like to shout out?
I've been listening to kind of random Italian film soundtracks, stuff on this label called Yoga, which I just discovered. It's like a reissue label that does sort of 80s new age stuff.
Oh.
I had never come across before, never heard of any of the acts they've reissued. So that's always exciting, finding things that you've no idea existed.
How do you come across your recent new records these days?
Normally it's recommendations from friends, same as it ever was, really. Obviously writing the books, I was kind of like focused on the eras I was writing about. So it's quite nice to kind of listen to stuff that's either new, which which I wasn't writing about, or just was that kind of completely outside the remit of the books I was doing. So yeah, fairly non-pop, mostly sort of quite beatless stuff that helps me go to sleep. I've been listening to a lot.
Does that mean that anytime you discover a new area of music, you're like, oh, this could be an idea for a book, or are you quite book fatigued now?
Yeah, no, I'm quite book fatigued. But I mean, obviously because of the band as well, if I hear anything new and interesting or inspiring, then that can go into songwriting as well. So
I was going to say, like, whilst doing the writing the books, did it change how you wrote music? by discovering like maybe some artists from like 1912 or 19, I mean, people you never really found before. Has any of it had an influence, anything you discovered?
Writing Let's Do It, there was a lot of things I'd never come across before. But I mean, I was writing about, you know, big bands and ragtime. I wouldn't say as much of a ragtime influence on our next album, but I think just the kind of like odd drones you get from like the big bands, especially the more kind of more sort of riff based ones, what I'd just be like sort of uniform drone of woodwinds. That was something I thought, well, that's we could definitely take that and do something with that. But no, by and large, I don't think our next album's going to sound like Bing Crosby or Scott.
What a shame! What a shame!
it's too expensive to get like an orchestra and a full band these days, isn't it? Really?
Well, that's it. That's the main reason. Yeah.
But yeah, you mentioned your book. Let's Do It, which I've got summarized here, is the first such history bringing together all musical genres to tell the definitive narrative of the birth of pop from 1900 to the mid 1950s. And yeah, as reading it, I think what blew my mind the most was how much of the history seems to have been lost already. Like, I'm so glad that you were there to capture it. But also, I mean, you make this point throughout, the music of the time, like music hall, vaudeville, the aforementioned Bing Crosby, so quickly becomes a punching bag before it becomes musical history that's really analyzed in with the respect that it should be. So, I mean, I'm guessing with Yeah, 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 your other book, which covers broadly kind of 1950 to now, I'm guessing there you might have dug deeper into areas that you already knew about, but how much of Let's Do It was totally brand new for you?
Quite a lot of it. I mean, there were things I had a pretty good knowledge of, but there were other areas that I knew either nothing about or had just like held absolutely no interest for me, like having to kind of confront sort of blackface performers in vaudeville, things like that was something that was like, you know, like obviously I was repelled by, so I'd never
the
bothered.
Songs, the names of the songs, it's really shocking when you're kind of listing them and it's a whole genre. And I think, is it Mae West used to do that kind of singing before she became famous, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's there was plenty of stuff I'd never come across, but there was if you're a woman and you were performing in vaudeville and you weren't considered particularly attractive, you could get away with singing very loudly and singing these very offensive songs. I don't even want to say what the name of that kind of was, but yeah, Mae West started out that way, and then obviously went off into films. Sophie Tucker is probably one of the more famous people who started like that, and her nickname was the Last of the Red Hot Mamas, which is quite a funny nickname because I don't know who the first of the Red Hot Mamas was. Like. No one ever seems to say that, you know, she was the last one. There was no, certainly with those two, there was no racism involved. That was just that was the only kind of way they could get on stage and make a living. And then like sort of use that as a jumping off point and became famous in their own right in quite different ways. But yeah, that's kind of where Mae West persona originates, which is just, it's very hard to get your head around. It's trying to make that kind of history seem relevant was tough because a lot of the things I was writing about seemed very easy to relate to the modern times. Even someone like Scott Joplin, right at the beginning of the 20th century, doing ragtime and, you know, thinking this is how ragtime should be written. And he writes kind of like, and then other people go off like Irving Berlin and do a very pop version and become much more famous. And Irving Berlin's tearing his hair out, writes something that's close to an opera based on ragtime, thinking that's going to be the thing for the ages. And of course, nobody knows it. And it's like, wow, that really recurs all the way through the whole of pop history. People attempting their sort of like grand statements, but what people really want to hear is the pop hit. So there's a lot of things like that were I found quite easy to relate to the modern day, but early days of Mae West, not so much.
Yeah, indeed. I also find interesting because we previously discussed Memphis Minnie on the podcast as an underrated act, and you do talk about the blues, so yeah, people like Ma Rainey, great Bessie Smith. I don't know, I've heard a little bit now, a little bit more after doing the Memphis mini episode, but yeah, was that something that probably there you already knew a little bit about? Did you find new gems in that world?
What I found there that I was completely unaware of was how successful they were, how famous Bessie Smith was, how many records she sold, and Mamie Smith, and how like someone like Robert Johnson or Blind Lemon Jefferson seems like a much more well-known name now. When I think Blind Lemon Jefferson did sell records, and Robert Johnson famously sold no records while he was alive. But his name is, you know, that's the revered name. It's not these women who actually were really successful and making much more fun records
and writing their own music, as you say, a lot of the time, which you. I don't know, you think they wouldn't be, actually, but many were.
Yeah, no, I was really surprised. I mean, you know, like people, sort of, Big Spiderbeck was obsessed with Bessie Smith. I used to follow her around when he was, like, still at school. He'd, like, bunk off school and go and see her shows and get his mates to come along as well. He found her really inspiring. So there's always kind of connections that I didn't really know about. But, yeah, the whole of Let's Do It is really the story of, like, racism in music as well. Because, you know, like, That's why she's not as well known as she should be, is because she was a woman and she was black, even though she sold a lot of records. And so that goes all the way through. I mean, because the book kind of ends in the 60s, really. I think that's when the Civil Rights Acts came through. So the entire period covered by the book is about segregation and white America just stealing music from black America most of the time. So I didn't want to make it too depressing. It's also the tale of how Britain and America relate to each other in the first half of the 20th century, which is, again, fascinating. You go back to 1900, and London was the absolute centre of like popular music. There was kind of no American music, really. No, it wasn't taken seriously, even by Americans. They thought all good music came from London or Vienna, mostly.
Now you've listened to Back so far, has it changed your views on artists from the 50s and 60s? I guess you already knew that the Stones borrowed or stole from previous, but can you still listen to those bands and forgive them? Like, does it tainted any of those artists for you?
It hasn't tainted them, but it's like it's much easier now to understand where all that stuff comes from. The Stones always, I think when I was writing Yeah, 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 it became apparent that the kind of the R&B that they were listening to and trying to promote when they went to America was music that Black America wasn't particularly interested in anymore. It was like a previous generation's music. And we don't want that stuff. We want to listen to Curtis Mayfield or something now. We're interested in civil rights and we don't want to like listen to this kind of like poor Southern blues music anymore. So what they were doing was kind of... really quite, I wouldn't say it was reductive, but it was certainly like backwards looking. Yeah, so writing Let's Do It, I could see where the roots of that stuff came from. I wasn't really hugely familiar with that either. But I mean, yeah, I've read a lot of books and a lot of people helped me out who are experts in that field. And
I mean, this might sound like a very basic question, but I am curious, how do you approach such a daunting task? Because... like, I will really praise you. Reading both books, that they are both so dense, but your attention never wavers. There's a lot of information, but it's easy to absorb. And as I emailed you, what really helped was putting on the music while listening along. And I think as I got to know your music taste, Bob, which I think is a bit different from mine, I kind of started to know what to put on. What I think would click more than not. Yeah, and I think we'll get into we will get into your beef with New Wave later, I'm sure. But how did you, you know, you said you were reading books, but how much of it is going to libraries, archives? How does one do this?
It's starting with a chapter breakdown so you don't go completely mad and trying to then finding bits, writing little sort of pockets of words, putting them in a file on your laptop, and then starting to find some kind of shape as it goes along. A chapter breakdown to start with was absolutely essential with both books because there was so much ground to cover. But with Let's Do It, even more than Yeah, 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 there were certainly points where I thought, what the hell have I done? I'm never going to finish it and it's going to be unreadable. But I really wanted both, especially Let's Do It because it's less familiar to most people. I wanted it to read like a story and to be... a bit of a romp as well as informative. I'm not an academic and I'm not an academic writer. So I wanted it to be fun.
Was there a chapter you struggled the most at writing or a period that you found hardest to engage in?
I mean, there's certainly some things took longer than others. I mean, country music is something that you could write, you could like just delve into forever. And there are so many kind of myths and self-contradictory things in country music that it's very hard to nail down. So that was tough with both books. There's only one chapter on country in each of them. And I probably could have done more. But it's,
well, I don't know. I was quite happy with this.
I mean, it's just the fact it's not based on anything real. I find fascinating. It's all completely sort of like self-mythologizing, and the fact it can have arguments about what's authentic country and what's not is really quite funny. But it's really intriguing. But it was very hard to get that down inside one chapter in each book.
I mean, for a while, you know, Taylor Swift was called country. That's how things change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she certainly started off as a country singer. But it's funny because, I mean, like listening to like what's called country music now and what was considered country music in the 90s, someone like Garth Brooks, who at the time just seemed like, I don't know, AOR? I couldn't see how he related to it at all. And you hear his songs now compared to what is now considered country. It's like, you know, he sounds like Johnny Cash or something. It's like, you know, it's... He really sounds like he clearly his roots are in country, and I couldn't hear that in the 90s. So it's, you know, it is a constantly evolving music, and it's not especially my bag, but I do find it probably more interesting to read about than to listen to.
But yeah, that's it. I think, you know, you touched upon the fact that you want both books to be a romp, and it does feel like that, because I do feel like sometimes you focus a bit more in on someone because they have an interesting life story or something. But what's very nice is even when you're doing that, there's always the songs and in the chart positions and everything. So I think that's a really nice way of telling a story with the music still in the foreground. So having, you know, with there's been a new edition because finished in 2013, if I remember correctly. But you've written an introduction this year, and you say in it, you know, great records are still being made in 2023. You just don't get them handed to you on a plate by the Weekly Music Press. I'm still finding gems from the modern pop age. So I think Fran already asked you kind of how do you discover music, but also do you think that writing Let's Do It, which is looking so far back, has changed your views on how you view the modern pop age? Because I think from that quote, you could maybe perceive that there's a bit of sadness that it doesn't drive pop culture in the same way, but is it just kind of the usual oldies being like, oh, back in my day, and it's just evolving all the time?
Well, I mean, clearly it's evolving all the time. I just think it's... I am sad that it isn't the cultural force it was. And it really isn't. And I think, I don't know, just going to festivals this summer, I was going to... I don't like festivals very much, but I go to festivals to promote books or do shows. And the demographic of people, because I've been going to Green Man for maybe like 15 years now, and the demographic is probably 15 years older now than it was when I first went. I'm thinking, well, this is odd. Where are the youngsters? What are they doing? Where are the kids of today? It's different. And I can't quite, there's no reason why I should understand how pop is being sort of passed around by younger people, because I'm nearly 60. So why should I? It's not there for me. You know, I think like John Peel was like an outlier when he was around. He was like the only person who was like in his 50s and listening to like current alternative music. So but now it feels like you have, not you have to be, but it feels like seems like it's meant to be a natural state, and I don't think it should be. I think it's music for young people. So I don't really mind that I don't understand how I'm meant to discover this stuff unless someone recommends it to me. Or I might just hear something on the radio. The thing that does make me sad, though, is that like if I'm sitting in the pub with a few friends and we'll talk about something we've discovered in the last couple of weeks, almost always we'll come up with something that the other people at the table haven't heard of. There's no consensus, and I do miss that. But I mean, that is, it's not that it was better in my day, but I miss that kind of like focus, I suppose, that everyone can have an opinion on something because everyone's aware of it.
Over-underrated.
You mentioned Charlie XCX as an example of an international pop star with little to no name recognition on the UK side streets, which is exactly why I picked her as underrated. It's absolutely crazy. I do still think, at least with female pop stars, there is still some sexism there, because, you know, when you look at Charlie's, maybe not record sales, but streams, she is huge and she never headlines festivals. Like, it's always second, and it's always some, okay, this is the wrong example, but Kings of Leon or Arctic Monkeys or whatever. And it's like, okay, yes, they are popular too, but they are not as much for the kids as someone like Charlie XCX is. So why is this still happening, that someone who is so dynamic and interesting is still not being promoted, not being pushed forward in the same way?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, she's you know, there are a lot of really great pop stars at the moment, nearly all female. And in Britain, maybe she's the best in Britain, I think. And she's been amazing.
I would agree, Bob. I would agree, yeah. But I think what's different as well, and maybe actually this didn't come across so clearly on your book, so I'd like to ask you the question, because I think why Charlie XCX is also quite a good modern pop star is because she's very accessible online, right? You know, she's always posting on social media. I don't know if you've seen her documentary about, you know, the album that she made in lockdown and stuff. But, you know, she's I really recommend it. It's quite good. But yeah, you know, she doesn't just communicate with fans, but she, you know, will ask for input. She'd be like, what should this be called? Which segment should I use? Which I think is quite wild, the fact that, yeah, now we have the internet that we can use in that way. And yeah, it made me think of, I don't know if you saw the Doja Cat controversy recently, where she basically called out her fans for being losers. She's like, if you care so much about what I'm doing, you're basically a loser, and lost 200,000 followers in a really short space of time for like not playing the game at all. But similarly, has now released an album that is getting quite critically acclaimed. So yeah, do you think that kind of accessibility is a bit more of a prerequisite for being a good pop star these days?
I suppose it is, but I mean, I think what's so good about Charlie XCX is that she still has a mystique, which you know, you'd think that, like, engaging with the fans that much, you'd lose the mystique immediately. I don't know, that's a real tightrope to walk, and she obviously does it. And you know, the photos she takes and puts online are uniformly amazing. I saw that series where she had to put a girl group together.
Oh yeah, amazing. Nasty Cherry. I love that.
That was great, because I mean, that was clearly very, you know, it was heard. It was like, you know, it wasn't fake in any way at all. She got so cross with him.
It is really worth it. And yeah, as a female, you know, pop and rock fan, I would have loved a program like that as a kid, to see these, especially because it was two musicians, two established musicians, but two people who were learning. One was learning to sing, one was learning to play the bass. So that kind of clash of like the experts and the newbies, it was really good. But let's move away from Charlie XCX, Fran.
Does that mean, though, that in the modern climate, if you're like Matt Johnson or Andy Partridge, you'd struggle massively, because, you know, they're people who shied away from the media. They wanted to, you know, do their own thing. I can't imagine them wanting to be on TikTok or, you know, doing that sort of stuff to get fans. So does it mean that people like that would not be as popular these days, maybe?
I think it'd be pretty hard to have a number one album. I think that they did have a number one album at one point, didn't they? Yeah, that'd be almost impossible, I think, because like the record company is not going to get behind you if you're not going to promote something, you know, like and come with fresh product or content or whatever all the time, which is it's really, you know, it's hard work. I'm not shy of social media particularly, but it's finding how to make it work is tricky, you know. So I mean, one thing I'm on is Twitter, which I seem to have the hang of, but I've tried an Instagram and can't get anywhere. So it's just like, you know, like playing a game and being on there. So you have to.
What's your Instagram handle, Bob, then, so everyone can go and follow you?
It's rocking_Bob.
There we go. All right. Hopefully a few more.
Because I guess like in the early 80s, you know, bands who were big in the 70s had started doing music videos, and they, you know, a lot of them were anti doing that. So I guess it's a similar sort of thing to these days. You know, you just have to keep re-changing how you're doing creative to how you're setting yourself, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, where I live in Yorkshire now, and there's the David Hockney Gallery. It's just like around the corner from where I live. And the fact that he like just keeps coming up with new work that's based around new technology is like, when he's in his 80s, it's like, yeah, that's what you have to do. That's the only way to like go through life and make, you know, write new music or make interesting films or whatever it is. You know, you've got to kind of stay on top of that, because that's how you're going to get fresh inspiration, or partly how you're going to get fresh inspiration. So, the thing of like, you know, not making videos in the 80s, I could understand it at the time, but looking back, it just feels very, it feels quite sort of conservative. And I mean, you know, the Clash not going on Top of the Pops, I always thought was just preposterous myself. I was like, couldn't understand that at all. And they must have grown up watching it. You know, what, I don't know what point you're trying to make here.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about rockism, because I think, yeah, your book describes, especially Yeah Yeah, as quite poptimist. I'm very grateful for you introducing me to Barbara Pittman, because I immediately went to listen to her when you said, there's more rock and roll in the 3 minutes of Passionate Dishevelment in Barbara Pittman's I Need a Man than the combined catalogues of Aerosmith and Motley Crue. That immediately piqued my interest. But I will say, I do prefer Handsome Man to I Need a Man. Yeah. But fantastic. And, you know, I did a bit of reading about her, and it's she only released a handful of singles, and she was very critical of her record label because they kept trying to give her very girly things, which were not her style at all. And yet she managed to have, like, you know, still a career, but unfortunately not that many songs. But yeah, I really found it quite interesting reading about rockism, because I think I agree with you on some points, Fran probably as well. I think we're both pop and rock fans. I am a reformed music snob, so I was really obsessed with pop in my youth. And then in my teenage years, I basically went, Muse and Radiohead are the only good band, sorry everyone. And then have now, you know, for my sins, come back. But it is true that rock is so varied and there's so much to enjoy, but it is quite frustrating that those attitudes, even now, are still perpetuating of, well, you know, there's no rock in the charts, there's no good music, and you're just like, come on. Firstly, there is still good rock, you just have to search for a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, do you still stand by that? Do you still feel that rockism is still quite pervasive?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, the fact that, like, every sort of 3 or 4 years a guitar band will come along and the press are absolutely all over them saying guitar music isn't dead, you know, we've got Fontaine's DC or something, I don't know,
or Idols.
Idols, you know, it's like, you know, there was a little wave of it about 3 years ago, wasn't there? And it'll go away and it'll come back in another 3 years, and it's, and I find it very, very tedious. It's like, you know, like, I don't know, like any revival, like, you know, blues is back, jazz is back, show tunes are back. It's like, who cares? It's like, you know, like, it's fine that those bands exist, but it's like, that's not the future of anything, you know, like, I think the rock era definitely kind of ends, you know, there was music called post-rock for a reason, you know, it was like, it ends in the 90s, I think. And I kind of go along with, I can't think if I put this in the book or not, Nick Cohen came up with a good theory about like a boulder in the middle of a lake and the ripples coming off it, and the boulder being rock and roll in the 50s, and all the ripples since just getting weaker and weaker until you end up with Fontaine's DC. I don't know.
So that means, what, in our lifetime, it's going to get pretty bleak, isn't it, as we go along?
I think there's plenty of exciting music that doesn't involve guitars, you know, or there's plenty of exciting music with guitars that doesn't sound like conventional rock, you know.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, this year, I mean, two bands that I like, Tiger Cub and DZ Death Rays, they've released pretty guitar heavy records, but they're just not as mainstream. I think that is it. It's a lot of people who are into rock are into rock because that was the music that was big in their youth, and now they see pop, they see hip-hop, they see whatever, and they're like, bah, it has gone to the dogs, it is only, you know, synthesizers, that's not a real instrument. And you're like, no, it's just, actually, you have to work a bit harder, it's not fed to you on a plate, and that's fine. I mean, with, I think both Fran and I have said that I certainly, with discovering new music, sometimes go through phases, but since doing this podcast, because we now do an end of year episode where we pick our 10 favorite songs of the year, I'm listening to new music much more consciously, because I'm like, well, I've got to talk about it at the end of the year, you know, I've got to have an opinion. And yeah. Maybe we didn't do that as much before doing the podcast.
I think being forced to, like, listen to new music is definitely a good thing. I kind of wish somebody would. I had a friend that had a show on WFMU. And when she started it, I think she was intending to play a lot of old stuff, ended up playing, by the end, she, like, pretty much only played new things, and was realized how much good music there is around. It's just that you have to really dig around for it, which is kind of the point I was making in the introduction to Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. It's definitely there. It's just, I wish there was more of a consensus. And I wish if somebody exciting came along, everybody was talking about them. It doesn't really seem to be.
Well, Taylor Swift, I think, being an exception, because what it seems to be now is you have these mega, mega, mega stars, and then a huge glut in the middle, and then obscurity, because, yeah, Taylor Swift, I mean, the records she's breaking are unbelievable, and she's someone who everyone knows, and, you know, most people know a couple of songs, But how many more Taylor Swifts are there at the moment? I don't know, because even, you know, you have the rappers, you have the reggaeton stars from Puerto Rico, etc., where they have a huge audience, but it doesn't have the same, as you say, kind of high street name check going on.
Her first record was, what, 15 years ago or something now? She's been around a long time. She still seems very current, and her records are phenomenal, and her presence is great.
This may be an impossible question, but I'll try it anyway. So obviously, our podcast is over underrated. So I was going to ask you, do you have an underrated year in pop and an overrated year in pop? Or is that too hard to answer?
Whoa, God, underrated year in pop. I mean, years I'm particularly fond of, 1989 I'm particularly fond of.
Mm-hmm.
People maybe don't talk about 1989 as much as 1988 because of Acid House, I suppose.
I guess, yeah, it's mainly Stone Roses and Madonna in 89, isn't that what I think about?
Yeah, Stone Roses and Happy Monday.
Well, Soul to Soul, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Italian House was everywhere, Black Box and Numero Uno and things. And Galaxy 500 broke through in 89. There was just like a lot of music from completely different areas.
Mm.
But again, I was writing for Melody Maker, so I was having to stay abreast of new music.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the reasons I found so many kind of really varied and fantastic new records. But I think it was a great year. I mean, the one problem with it is that Jive Bunny had three number ones.
And... I tried to explain to someone recently about Jive Bunny.
And I have no idea what Jive Bunny is.
You really kind of don't need to know. It was it was terrible.
The sad thing about it is I actually discovered a lot of 50s rock and roll through Jive Bunny because I was like 8 or 9 years old. So for me, it was a discovery, but obviously it was one of the most annoying things that's ever recorded.
That's like a bit earlier, there was like Stars and 45 about in what, 81, which was like a Beatles medley. And it, for some weird reason, they picked quite obscure Beatles album tracks, which I didn't know at the time. It started with No Reply and I'll Be Back, which are hardly the go-to Beatles song, doing a Beatles medley, and I didn't know them, and so that's how I was introduced by this cheesy Dutch medley of Beatles songs. That's how I discovered those songs.
I really think there's no shame in how you're introduced to a song. Like I was reading kind of the latter half of Yeah more recently, so I was reading about Britpop and Dinosaur Jr. and I had a flashback to I discovered Dinosaur Jr. from an episode of Skins. Because Skins, the TV show, famously had quite a good soundtrack. And I remember kind of my boyfriend at the time being like, oh my God, is that how you discovered it? Because he was also a music snob. We were music snobs together. And now I'm like, I think I discovered Sonic Youth thanks to Gilmore Girls from Shazamming. I was like, this song sounds pretty good. Who cares how you discover us? If it's good music, it's good music. End of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over underrated.
Well, I'm originally from Portugal. I grew up in England and now I'm in Belgium. So obviously anything relating to kind of anything European, I found quite interesting to read, for example, about the Beatles of the different European countries. But I wanted to get your take on kind of, I guess, the monolingualism of the British music chart, because coming from Portugal, what's interesting is you look at the chart and it's like there will be Portuguese music, Spanish music, English music, French, like other things will break through. And what I've always found quite sad in the UK is, you know, apart from, you know, the odd Edith Piaf or Serge Gainsbourg here and there, that hasn't really happened. It's maybe changing now with stuff like K-pop. But, you know, have you ever had a passion to kind of, I know obviously you worked with some people like Etienne Dahel, but did you ever have a passion for kind of European pop? And is that something that you came across easily or did you have to go and find it as well?
No, I mean, I had to go and find it. I was, we were lucky enough to like do a lot of touring in the sort of early mid 90s. And I'd always like go to sort of market stalls and pick up records that looked interesting. So that's how I came across Jacques Dutronc and Michel Polnareff and a lot of French performers who are now pretty famous everywhere. But I mean, they certainly weren't at the time. I'd never heard of them at all. France Gall, never heard of her. I mean, Francois Hardy and Johnny Hallyday were about the only people, and Serge Gainsbourg, obviously, mm-hmm. the only people. France that people were in Britain were familiar with. So yeah, it was really exciting to go and find things when I went to other countries or the Swedish bands that I write about. And yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, there's odd things like 99 Red Balloons was the number one in America in German.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only country in the world that didn't go with the original German. We had to have it translated. And that's in the mid 80s. And it's like, God, that's embarrassing, really embarrassing. So I think, you know, the kind of Little Englander thing is, it can be there, and, you know, you're not even aware of it, because I didn't know that until quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
America's almost certainly had more foreign language number ones than we have.
I think now the trend, really, there's so many Spanish language musicians who are so big. Mm. And yeah, I mean, one that's bucked the trend, not just in America, Rosalía, you know, she is massive. And it's been so interesting to talk to English friends who are really into her and do not speak a word of Spanish, because I'm like, in the past, I think this would have been a barrier to some of you. But, you know, her music is so interesting, her stage presence is so amazing that it doesn't matter. So more of that, please.
Mm.
And yes, we have to ask you, Bob, what is your beef with New Wave? It was really surprising to read your, because we are both New Wave fans. And in fact, maybe the reason why this podcast started is because of two bands that I think you're not such a fan of, Arcadia and Power Station. So I was just so curious, because I feel New Wave more than anything. I feel like you gave so many genres such a chance, so many bands such a chance, even when it was so obvious that you didn't like it. But yeah, tell us, why are you not such a big fan of New Wave?
Oh, dear. I mean, New Wave, to me, at the time, just felt like an accessible version of, not accessible version of punk, but it was like, it felt like punk with, I don't know, skinny ties. And it was like, the look I found pretty horrible. And the fact it just seemed to be people who couldn't break through any other way, but apart from taking bits of the punk look and feel, I suppose, without having any of the kind of politics. And obviously post-punk was amazing as well. So it wasn't like, you know, you could, that punk was obviously a bit of a dead end in itself, but its influence was incredible. But New Wave just seems to take the worst elements of it and amplify them, I suppose. I don't know.
I'm a big fan of the New Romantic scene, but I guess you're calling about as new pop, because I never really heard about that phase before. But when I've been reading up about bands in the history, people would always call that the futurism movement, or, you know, or New Romantics. But you don't describe like Duran Duran or Band about it as New Romantics. When was it described at a time then as new pop, and this New Romantic label wasn't really a thing?
Oh no, New Romantics, absolutely. It was a very specific period, I think, kind of end of 1980 into 81. For probably less than a year, New Romantics was a phrase that was bounced about for Duran Duran, Visage, Spandau Ballet.
Mm.
And by kind of the middle of 81, I think they'd all kind of like just gone off in their own direction. And it was new pop was I mean, it's a phrase that Paul Morley came up with in NME. And it covered people like ABC, the Human League, who definitely weren't New Romantics. I mean, they just came out of like oddball electronica, really. So it did cover some of the New Romantic groups, new pop, but it was really about kind of entries and being really quite strange, but still having chart hits and being quite unique. So, like, you know, even Dexys probably could be fodder under new pop, I think, in 82. Yeah, it was a period where like it wasn't embarrassing to be on TV or on Top of the Pops or on Seaside Special or anything, you know, like it's like, and you can go on there and sing Being Boiled, you know, like the Human League did. It's like, that's quite an achievement, I think. Or even doing like a weird sort of minimal synth version of Tainted Love and getting to number one. It's like it's you're just so over familiar with that song. It now doesn't seem, and you can't hear the weirdness in it, how it felt at the time. That was a very strange thing to happen and to be such a big hit. And that was definitely new pop. But yeah, I think it's a phrase I really like. New Romantics is definitely a more limited period and limited number of groups, I think, based around the Blitz Club in London and the Rum Runner, I think it was called, in Birmingham.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That's pretty much it. That was it. It wasn't anywhere else.
So when he's mentioned Arcade and Power Station, it's not that we're like avid fans. It was just when I first created like an idea for a podcast. I also find it really interesting that Duran Duran were the only band I could think of who basically split into two other bands and then came back in, and everyone was fine with it. And I always found like a weird thing that not many people my age are aware of this secret identity, like Arcade and Power Station, but they're like massive in America and have like a success, but no one really knows about it. So my idea was to ask people to listen to Arcadia and Palisades and then give me their thoughts and come back to me. Obviously, it's a very limited audience. So when I picked up on your Arcadia and Palisades, I was like, who would have thought they'd get mentioned in the book as well?
Well, I mean, I think Duran Duran was so huge at the time that these side projects were automatically going to be massive. And I think the Power Station being with Robert Palmer and was it Bernard Edwards? It was, wasn't it? Yeah, and it's just, I don't know. It was their music makes me feel physically ill, I've got to say.
With big kicking drums, eh?
It brings me out in a cold sweat.
But yeah, like I said, I just had to ask because I really felt like every genre got a fair hearing, but New Wave, I was like, there's something going on. There's some trauma, some musical trauma here. And it might have been that it was everywhere. And maybe you had other interests that weren't breaking through as much. Was that part of it, do you think?
I was pretty young at the time. I think it was just people who seemed, I mean, again, it's a very kind of like snobbish thing to say, but people who seemed clearly fake. The Police seemed clearly fake to me. The Police were called The Police. Imagine calling your group The Police. It's like, how? What an awful name. What
I did enjoy reading your section on The Police and Sting.
And just that thing of like Stuart Copeland in videos, like rolling his eyes in a kind of like new wavy face. It's like that side of it. There was plenty of new wave stuff I did like, which gets filed under new wave, certainly by Americans. And I think, you know, I really like new music and I like the Buggles, the more sort of synthy stuff that predates kind of...
How about Devo?
I'm not a fan, no. No, kind of like deliberately quirky isn't something that just rubs me up the wrong way as well.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into what you're saying about the B-52s because, you know, we're having a good time, Bob, but...
I really like B-52s. What did I say about
them? I think it was talking about their quirky look, I think. And I was like, no, but this is what everyone does. And then they don't listen to the music. Ah, okay, but you like B-52s.
I mean,
okay,
Give Me Back My Man is like absolutely one of my favourite records of all time. I think it's incredible. Oh. I think Fred Schneider gets in the way, but I mean...
but this is what a lot of people say. I did buy his solo record, which I haven't listened to yet. But I don't know. I think he's a good contrast because they're, you know, the ladies' voices are so like... epic.
They're incredible. Their harmonies are incredible. They really are. They're underrated, definitely.
And now a short break.
Do you listen to albums start to finish? Do you love concept albums? Are you always the first one at a party to bring up King Gizzard? Say no more. The Album Concept Hour podcast has everything you need. We have hot takes.
It's like Voltron.
It's just like Voltron. Ah. It's like Voltron with jazz. This is emo. This is Willie Nelson's emo trip. Bad improv attempts.
That was.
Let's all
British.
Do our best Aussie accent.
Let's not.
Let's alienate all the Australians.
And sometimes we even learn something. As they listened again and again to the song in the control room, Axel started saying, "Where do we go? Where do we go now? Where do we go?"
Shut up.
Spencer turned down the music and said, "Why don't you just try singing that?" And thus the last part of the song was born. Listen to the Album Concept Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to part two. And this time we're going to be talking about Bob's five picks from five underrated artists that he's talked about in his books. So, Bob, what's your first pick?
My first pick is Frankie Lane, who's kind of like a sort of pre-rock and roll figure who was absolutely huge in the late 40s, early 50s. And he's pretty much forgotten now. If he's remembered at all, it's for kind of... He did the original version of I Believe, which, you know, everyone from Robson and Jerome to whoever has done it. It's horrible sort of religious ballady thing. But he also did lots of like really quite spooky... kind of, I guess, you know, early 50s, Atomic Age weirdness that I imagine David Lynch would like. Joe Meek was certainly a big fan and pinched a few things off him. And this song I've picked for the show is called Swamp Girl, which is a great title. So it could be a 50s B-movie anyway. This is kind of like, he's got a really powerful voice. He was one of the few first people after the big band era to be like a club singer, you know, to like just perform on his own, get a crowd going. That just didn't exist before the war. Him and Johnny Ray and a couple of others were big stars in that field. And but he's my favourite. He's the best of the lot, I think.
Well, I knew the name Frank Iain, but I couldn't really think of a song until I realised that he did Rawhide. It's Rawhide.
Yeah.
And the only reason I know that was because of the Blues Brothers, to be fair.
Right, yeah.
I don't think I've even heard the original. So, yeah, I came in completely cold. And, yeah, it reminded me, it was a bit of Stingray, especially with, like, the backing vocals. So, woo,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, Marina. It's got a lot of drama. And I enjoy it when the tempo goes up and he's sort of singing about the girl with the golden hair. But I think you said in your book that Mark Almond became a bit over theatrical for you. And yeah, this reminds me of the late 80s Mark Almond. So is this where he got it from?
Yeah, I'm sure his parents were probably playing Frankie Iain records. Mine were, and he's a little bit older than me. Yeah, he was a huge star. So I think anybody my age or like 5-10 years older is going to have been aware of Frankie Iain being on the radio when they were a kid, definitely on Radio 2, all their parents would have had the records or grandparents. So yeah, quite possible Mark Almond heard those things as well, yeah.
I was going to ask, are you a fan of an artist who is just a singer? Does being a singer make it more as interesting as someone who does both, or what's your thoughts on that?
Not really. I mean, I suppose my favourite people tend to be unique, I suppose. And Frankie Iain didn't write his own material, but he was still pretty unique. He was kind of moulded by... he started off, as a club singer, like a edging towards R&B. But, I mean, like, there weren't really white R&B singers in the 40s. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of shaped by the producer, Mitch Miller, who decided he would actually sound great singing these mad Western songs and... things like Cry of the Wild Goose, these very dramatic, sort of spooky tunes. And that did, it did suit him. And he had like huge hits with them. Theme from High Noon he did, Rawhide, like you said. He was kind of like, he was like a self-made figure, I suppose. He kind of like, you know, he kind of had this personality. He, with a bit of help, he built his own personality. So, I mean, I like people who have a unique persona and you don't need to write your own songs to do that, but I suppose it usually helps.
I don't think I'd ever heard of Frankie Iain, but I loved this song and I loved reading about his mad life from your book, Bob. His father was Al Capone's barber and he saw his grandfather get shot in 1920 Chicago because he was somehow involved in gangs. And the bit on the dance marathons. So I've got a quote here from your book. So he I don't know if you got to this, Fran, but he broke a record because he did a dance marathon with his partner, Ruth Smith, where he danced for 145 days at Young's Million Dollar Pier in Atlantic City. And then he at some point got a bad ankle and had to go to hospital for 8 weeks. So I think just that alone, not even going into Mitch Miller dressing him up as a cowboy and anything else, you're like, wow, this man is great. But I'm really glad that I listened to the song, I think, before reading about his life, because I thought it was really gothic and unsettling. I immediately wrote, he feels like the 50s Nick Cave. And I think you agree, Bob, because you compared him to Nick Cave, Lee Hazelwood and the Cramps, which I also agree with. And this song absolutely sets him apart to the other crooners because, his voice is so lush and so varied. But I really, really believe in his storytelling. And every time it gets to the ending, I get the shivers, the way that it builds. I think as well, it's really nice that you have the voice of the Swamp Girl as well to set it apart. So yeah, this was definitely one of my favorites from your list.
Great. Lovely.
And on to your next pick, Bob.
Sweetheart by Peggy Lee is, I think, was a follow-up to Fever, which makes sense because it sounds quite a lot like Fever. But she wrote this one. I mean, Fever, she didn't write, but she completely deconstructed Little Willie John's original, which is equally great, but is very full on, you know, it sounds like Fever. And her version is obviously incredibly cool and just like basically like a bass line and finger snapping. That was all down to her. I mean, she's really underrated because she was a songwriter for a start, a woman songwriter in the 40s and 50s, which, you know, writing her own material was almost unheard of. So she wrote, you know, the Lady and the Tramp soundtrack she wrote and sang. So
yeah, I didn't know that.
And but anyway, this song is like, this is a follow up to Fever. I mean, Fever in its own right just like kind of invents this strain of what we could now call popcorn, which it was very big in Belgium. And Sweetheart is a really great example of it. It's a very cool record to play out. And I love her voice, and I'm always pleased. I think the Peggy Lee chapter in Let's Do It is one where people have said, "Oh, I love that chapter. I didn't know anything about it before, and now I'm obsessed with Peggy Lee." A few people have said that, which is I'm very, very happy about.
I'd never heard this. I knew Fever, obviously. I said it's a similar vibe. It's a bit Chicago jazz, bouncy bass, like a bit of Femme Fatale. Is it Jack Marshall? Was he the guy who worked on it as well?
Quite possibly. I couldn't tell you.
Because the only thing I could see that he did was the theme tune to The Munsters. So big fan of that, obviously. So Peggy Lee, Munsters.
Yeah, they're kind of... I mean, I can see that. A lot of those arrangers did... sort of TV things like, I'm trying to think now, Nelson Riddle did Route 66, and Neil Hefti, who did loads of Frank Sinatra arrangements, did the Batman theme.
Oh, really?
That's probably what he's now best remembered.
Batman comes up on our podcast a lot, so it all fits into place. Okay.
So those arrangers were all amazing and sort of multi-talented. Jack Marshall, I didn't know that. I know his name, but I couldn't have told you. Did the Munster theme.
Babs didn't know about this track beforehand, or?
Like you, Fran, I knew Peggy of Fever fame, and that was it. And I would agree, Bob, that it's a really entertaining chapter in Let's Do It. I mean, the facts for Peggy Lee, outside, you know, of what we just mentioned, of Fever and Lady and the Tramp, she was the inspiration for Miss Piggy, because initially it was Miss Piggy Lee, that's what I read in your book. Yeah. And potentially she's the inspiration for the name of the margarita cocktail as well. As well as being someone who has recorded over 1,100 masters and composed over 270 songs. So, I mean, what a woman. And yeah, I would agree that she's underrated, given that we only know Fever, I would say, most of us these days, and she has a lot more going on, clearly. I thought the song was really playful. I liked the percussion. And the key changes, which are kind of get higher and higher and spookier. But yeah, I was curious, Bob, why you picked, you have so much to pick from. Why did you pick this song over any others of her catalogue?
Well, I thought because you'd probably know Fever, it was kind of like related. I mean, and she wrote it. I wanted to pick something she'd written. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, I could have gone right through to the 70s. She had a Paul McCartney song in 73, I think, called Let's Love, which he wrote especially for her because he loved Peggy Lee, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's a beautiful song, and her voice is amazing on it. I think she kept her voice really well because she undersings the whole time. I mean, she knew her sort of like limitations, and worked around them, and had this amazing voice. So she managed to keep her singing chops right until she was, until she died, really.
Although I like her marketing style, because the way that she talked about it, according to your book, was she said, I have to ration my voice, which sounds much more mysterious than, like, if I sing too much, it's going to give out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to ration it.
Yeah. Right.
It's a precious commodity. And continuing perhaps on unique voices, what's your next pick, Bob?
Yes, Lucrece is my next pick. I've been listening to him all day, actually, because I'm writing a sleeve note for a new compilation. He's got a unique voice. I think it's four octave range he's got. And he's still with us. I saw him a few years ago in Palm Springs. I saw him one night and Frankie Valli a couple of nights later playing in,
wow,
down the road. And it's like, in my head, they're like equal sort of giants of... falsetto singing, and Lou Christie was singing to like a pre-recorded tape, and Frankie Valli was obviously in this huge casino with a massive band and 10,000 people there. I thought, Lou Christie, he is just that big in my head, isn't he? He's not that big a star, even though he should be. So this song is If My Car Could Only Talk, which is a sort of typically obtuse title. He came with some really great titles. Back to the Days of the Romans, that was a good one. But he was still, he still had massive hits in the mid-60s. Lightning Strikes is his most famous song. But this one, it's produced by Jack Nitzsche, who did work with Phil Spector, and you can tell it's a really big production. The lyrics are quite hard to work out, and when the single first came out and wasn't selling, they then did a picture sleeve with the lyrics printed on so you could follow the story, but it still didn't sell. But I love this thing. It's a fantastic record.
Speaking of Frankie Valli, I was at my local theatre and Gareth Gates is playing Frankie Valli at the moment. So
it's got a good voice. Why not?
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of a guy with a high voice. I like a bit of Prince, Bee Gees, Morton Harkett.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love falsetto as well. I mean, can Gareth Gates...
This is the thing. I don't remember him doing that in Pop Stars, but, you know, let's see. Well, actually, I won't. But
let's not make any claims we can't follow up on.
But yeah, I can't. Yeah, I knew the name Lucretia. I couldn't picture. And then so when it starts off, obviously, it takes a while before he suddenly hits into that high register. And I was like, oh, wow. So it took me a while to sort of like get my head around it. But then the hook started to come in and the melody. And the more I listened to it, the more I liked it. I put down here Spector Sound. I adore the female backing singers, like a backing choir almost. And I love the tempo changing. And yeah, is it about him like finding like his girlfriend's been cheating on him? Is that the story, I assume?
Yeah, he finds sort of like clues in his car. He went through his car while he was away and finds like a pendant that shouldn't be there or something that I can't remember. But his car could talk, it would give her away.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I loved it, to be fair. Thank you for introducing me to Luke Christie.
Oh, he's great. There's a lot more where that came from.
Obviously, another interesting guy. I'll read a quote from So Luke Christie was a Playgirl centrefold, cut a Polish-Italian take on what's going on, gave up pop to become a truck driver, married Miss Great Britain. I mean, did he ever live in the UK? Do you know, Bob?
Yeah, he did. He lived in Hampstead, opposite Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, as you do.
As one does. Yeah, I loved learning about him in your book. I also don't mind a male falsetto either, but this song, yeah, really, really took me by surprise. I did feel, I've listened to it quite a few times now, I still feel like it's kind of all over the place. Like, yeah. Even though I now know how it's going to go. Yeah, it kind of wrong-foots me, and it's maybe a bit too bubblegum poppy for me, but I really enjoyed the lyrics of A Broken Heart. I'm glad that I went to look at them because it is quite evocative, but I like the both of you, I agree that it's not totally obvious. And I think If My Car Could Only Talk actually sounds like he's in love with his car rather than anything else as a title. So I'm sure that's going to confuse some people. But I will say that I went to listen to a few other songs of his and I really, really liked Trapeze.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I would recommend that from my side for further listening.
And then to the song with one of the longest intros I've ever heard.
this is more for the producer and writer Tom Bell. Than mm-hmm. I mean, Johnny Mathis, I think he's got an amazing story as well. I mean, he was like, he could have been an Olympic athlete, and he had the choice between doing the long jump in the Olympics or becoming a professional singer. You know, we should be so lucky as to have a choice like that. So he's kind of fascinating in his own right. But Tom Bell is like really one of my heroes. He invents Philly Soul, basically. He invents sort of this kind of orchestrated soul in the early 70s with French horns and sitars, you know, anything that came into his head, he'd use. And he had the talent to pull it off. He was he's a great arranger. Johnny Mathis, he got offered to work with Johnny Mathis, and he was like, yeah, of course I'll work with Johnny Mathis. He saw Johnny Mathis as a leader, is what his description of him was, which I don't think many people would say. He interviewed him before they did the production and to get stories about his life, and then wrote lyrics that were based around what Johnny Mathis had told him in this interview, which is it's an incredible way of I've never heard of anybody else doing that. And so this song's Life is a Song Worth Singing. And yeah, it has a very epic sort of opening. I think he wanted it to be like he was a gladiator entering the ring, is what Tom Bell said. So there's this big build-up from coming through the crowd or something. But yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. It was a good lyric, and put Johnny Mathis in a place where nobody expected him, because he was just seen as this very sort of like milky MOR singer before. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I knew a child was born, and that's basically it. So I was not expecting this. You know, this is like Isaac Hayes or something. I was like, okay, this is a very different world. But Tom Bell, so he make me feel brand new and do everything. And then I realized that the Fugees had, I didn't know the Fugees had taken his track in Ready or Not as well. But yeah, no, I loved it. I loved the swagger, dancing rhythms. The more I listened to it, the more I got from it. It's got a false ending. I'm a big fan of false ending. I probably listened to it maybe 6 or 7 times, and I keep going back to it. And it just leads me into a fantasy world. And who knew that Johnny Mathis could be this cool?
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom Bell.
Yeah, definitely thanks to Tom Bell. I don't think Johnny Mathis knew he could be that cool. I mean, genuinely, I think he just didn't realise he had it in him to do that.
Have you seen the front cover of the single?
No, I've only got an
idea. It's in like a furry jacket with like a hunting rifle out in the swamps. I've got no idea what that's got to do with the song, but hey.
No, I haven't seen that.
Check it out.
I had heard of Johnny Mathis, but I could not put him to anything. So I was so shocked when I went on Wikipedia and it told me that he's the third best-selling artist of the 20th century. Wow. He sold over 360 million records worldwide. I mean, what a career, because his discography kind of covers bloody everything: Latin American country music, soft rock, blues, disco. He alluded to being gay in maybe the 90s and got death threats for it without even properly coming out, and then only came out a bit more clearly later. Like, a very, very interesting person. But yeah, this was my favorite song from the playlist for sure. I love the cinematic intro. It reminded me a bit of Tubular Bells, and then I was like, is this ridiculous? And then I looked it up and they both came out in the same year, so I was like, okay, fair enough. I loved all the different instruments that come in. Like Fran, I've listened to it now 6, 7, 8, 9 times, and I'm still getting enjoyment out of it. I also wrote about loving the false ending, but I wanted to ask you, maybe both, because I'm so ignorant about soul. Is this kind of prog soul? Because that's what it sounds like to me, because it's so long and epic. But I know that this is in a chapter in your book, Bob, called The Sound of Philadelphia. So is this Philly soul, prog soul, somewhere in between? Where does this sit? Because this is totally new to me.
It is somewhere in between, I think, because like Norman Whitfield was doing stuff at Motown, which was being called psychedelic soul, but like most of the time was prog. I mean, it was like things with the Temptations are like, sidelong songs, like 15-minute songs and stuff. Tom Bell would definitely have got, that would have been an influence on this. Same with Isaac Hayes, which again, I think is kind of prog soul. Nobody called it that at the time, I don't think. It makes sense, definitely makes sense.
Were they able to emulate this live, these sort of bands? Of course, there's so many textures and like strings and all sorts. Like, it must have been pretty expensive to be able to take like a 20-piece band on tour to be able to get the full sound. So I wonder how they toured with this old music, or is it completely stripped back?
Well, I think the Temptations. You see the Temptations live in the 70s, and it's just a band with a brass section.
Okay.
I don't think they even tried, and they have to like rearrange all these normal Whitfield things. And I think they hated doing them a lot of the time because they were just like they were a harmony group, it's a bit different if it's someone like Johnny Mathis because it's you. But I mean, like when you're a harmony group and you have these like sort of 5-minute sort of like work before you start singing again, you're just like kicking your heels with no instrument to hang on to. So yeah, no, I don't think they did reproduce it live. But I could well be wrong. I mean, I've never seen footage of. I don't know what Isaac Hayes would have done live. That would have been interesting to see. I mean, he must have played. I don't know. Good question.
As someone who is new to this genre, you've mentioned Isaac Hayes, but are there any other acts or songs that you would recommend that are kind of similar to this genre that you'd really recommend for me to go to next?
Well, Tom Bell, I did a compilation of. In fact, self-promoting here. I did a compilation
for
Norman Whitfield Productions called Psychedelic Soul, and I did a Tom Bell one called Ready or Not, which are just like my favourite arrangements by both of them. Norman Whitfield is definitely where it starts. It did Cloud Nine with the Temptations, Psychedelic Shack, Just My Imagination. And then he did stuff with the Undisputed Truth, which is very similar, really drawn out. But yeah, I don't know. Beyond that, the Isley Brothers, maybe early 70s stuff, which is more psychedelic than prog. But I don't know. Yeah, those two I'll definitely start with as producers because they're such distinctive sounds.
A lot to go on. Brilliant.
Over underrated.
And finally, a different sort of genre we're going to now.
Shut Up and Dance. Yeah, I absolutely loved Shut Up and Dance when they were going, and think, you know, I thought, well, you know, that with everything that's happened since going through sort of breakbeat, jungle, drum and bass into grime, they're clearly like the forerunners of pretty much all of it, and they really don't get the credit. You know, I think, you know, people know them, and it's like they're not obscure. That their cheek was brilliant as well. I mean, that they sample stuff without any intention of clearing it. The most mainstream things are Annie Lennox or Terence Trent D'Arby, mainstream current things in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, it really appeals to me, just like the sort of the humour, the roughness, the DIY quality, and the fact they had this absolutely massive hit. And when they did it on Top of the Pops, you couldn't go out and buy it the next day because it's based on Walking in Memphis by Mark Cohen, which is very obvious, but they changed it to Put on My Raving Shoes instead of Put on My Blue Suede Shoes and things like that. And he objected, so I had to withdraw the single. And they said, well, we pressed 30,000 copies or whatever. And he said, well, you can sell them and then you can't repress it. So they sold out in a week. The record went in the chart at number 2 and then just fell off the chart completely the following week. But yeah, so it's... They're great. I mean, they're a big inspiration. We kind of like tried to do a couple of things that sounded like them. You'd never guess all we had, but they were the main inspiration. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
My brother had this on vinyl when I was a kid. So I was lucky when I was like 10 or 11, my brothers were into like, you know, illegal raves. And I didn't know that this wasn't an original. I just thought this was an original song. Walking Memphis was when I was 10 years old. I think it's only until Cher did a cover later on, but I realized it was even a cover. So I remember like maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, I thought, oh yeah, I want to listen to some old rave tracks from the early 90s. And I played this and thought, this isn't the song. And then I've now realised why, when you find a compilation, it's a different version. You had to redo because of copyright reasons. But yeah, you have to go to YouTube to be able to hunt down the original version of I'm Raving and Raving. And yeah, and because of this, you know, in the early 90s, I was a big fan of like, you know, piano with a breakbeat, like I guess the early happy hardcore sound was kind of my thing. And you know, that period of like the Prodigy, and it has a fondness in my heart because that's the first music I ever went to. My first gig was the Prodigy in 1992, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
Nice.
When I was 11 years old.
Were you not terrified?
I met my older brother, obviously. I'm not that cool. And they're playing like upstairs in the BIC in Bournemouth. There's like maybe 20 people, and they just brought out maybe 3 singles. So, you know, they weren't the band we think of now. You know, they were the proper, like, you know, long hair, baggy T-shirts, rave culture thing. And I was just at the front, and Max didn't give me the microphone, so I could go, woo-hoo, woo-hoo. And then Keith gave me a T-shirt, and my best friend nicked it for me at a party 5 years later. So, never forgiven him.
Ooh, that's bad.
Unforgivable.
So thank you for, you know, some nostalgia here, Bob. Babs, have you ever heard of Shut Up and Dance?
I mean, I really can't follow that because, yeah, so I was living in England by 1991, but I was 4 years old, so I can't remember this at all. However, I had forgotten, I don't think I discussed this with you beforehand, Fran, that Scooter did a version of this song, the German band, and it's worth checking out because... Yeah, it's an interesting version, but the music video is also quite epic because it's just them in black and white kind of staring in the distance, and then different people come along behind them, and there's some quite earnest YouTube singles being like, you know, I don't usually like Scooter, but this is clearly their best song. And it's like, yeah, but it's not even their song, and it's not even, you know, this goes back and back and back and back. But I absolutely love this. And it was so kind of sad reading about the fact that, yeah, when they went on Top of the Pops, it wasn't the version that thankfully, you know, we can still find on YouTube. It's a good song, but it doesn't have the same effect, you know, knowing that you know it's Walking in Memphis. So no nostalgia for me, but I appreciate the introduction. And I will give a plug, because I don't think we mentioned this on this season of the podcast yet, but I can't really listen to this kind of music at the moment without thinking of the parody song Planet of the Bass. I don't know if you've got around to it, but It is very good, and that's also what it reminds me of, especially after watching the scooter version. So yeah, what an interesting story. Selling records out of the back of their car, brilliant.
Yeah, you know, so that was pretty commonplace at the time, selling white labels at the boot of your car. Because a lot of those records would have had no sample clearance. I can't imagine the Prodigy cleared Charlie the Cat for Charlie either.
Yeah, that also makes sense why on the Experience album, it's also not the same version as Charlie. The sample's gone from the album again.
Yeah, you're right. God, I hadn't thought of that.
Come on, big annoying
from
the
water. Such cycles. I think we've talked about sampling before, but actually, coincidentally, just before coming on the podcast, I think it's an Instagram account I follow called shesaid.so, which is about kind of women in music. And they were talking about how interpolation is the new fashion at the moment. So it's not necessarily a sample, but it's taking lyrics from an existing song and changing it. So for example, in the Speed Drive by Charlie XCX, which we mentioned in another episode, it's an interpolation of Oh Mickey, You're So Fine, where she doesn't sing that exactly. She says, Barbie, you're so fine. And that seems to be the trend at the moment. But back in 1991, this was the trend, and whether you were alive or not, guys, check it out. It is a fun listen. So Bob, thank you very much for coming along, and we very much enjoyed reading your books. Do you have anything to plug, your books, your social media and beyond? Please go ahead.
Well, what do I have to plug? I did a book on the Bee Gees. I can't remember if we mentioned that or not. I don't think we did, did we? Called The World, which came out in the spring. Yeah, 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 and Let's Do It have both just come out in paperback. Yeah, Yeah, it's 10th anniversary now, which is a bit frightening for me. It doesn't seem that long. So I've written a new chapter for the end of that. And they're the things I've got to plug. St. Etienne in the studio at the moment, doing a new album that hopefully will come out next autumn, I think it's the plan.
Great. And crucially, because we mentioned this in part one, where can we follow you on social media, Bob?
I'm at @rocking_Bob on Twitter and Instagram, but I'm not really on Instagram. I'm mostly on Twitter. So probably soon I won't be on anything.
So find Bob on social media while you can. A rare treat. Fran, any final thoughts for this episode?
No, well, obviously buy the books, listen to St. Etienne. And if you do see them, if they are touring later on in 2024, check them out, please. And thanks, Bob, for doing our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Bob. See you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to today's special episode, and thanks to Bob for coming on and introducing us to Frankie Lane, Lou Christie, and many others. It's a fascinating chat with him, and I can really wholeheartedly recommend his books. As I said in the episode, they're dense but really easy to read and entertaining, and if you play along the music that he's talking about, it really brings the books to life very nicely. So do recommend going for Bob's books, Yeah 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 and Let's Do It. In the meantime, if you have more underrated gems from across the pop age, don't hesitate to get in touch. We are still on Twitter at OU Music Pod. We are on Instagram at @OverUnderratedMusicPod, and you can email us at OverUnderratedMusicPod@gmail.com. We are now also on Blue Sky, also at OU Music Pod. So if you're on there, come and give us a follow. I have to say that I have not done much on there yet, but who knows, it might transform into something spectacular. Do check out more of our back catalogue. We are on season 7 after all, plenty to go back on. And if you have any suggestions of topics or themes you'd like to cover, let us know. Bye for now.
You have been listening to Over Underrated.